very special edition of Nota Bene, but all very special editions, aren't they, Nate Freeman?
I love them all like I would my multiple children.
If you had that many children, I'd never see you. your hands would be even fuller than they are now.
It's true.
But anyway, we are currently in the office recording live to tape of the Broadway Gallery with the show that you and I organized or curated.
Co-curated.
Like to say organized, but in any case, is just about done being installed. It looks great out there.
Looks great.
I'm very happy with it. I did make the mistake of telling Al Freeman during our taping of the last episode that she had all the time in the world to make her work, and she's taken that to heart. So we are still waiting on Al's piece. Hopefully it arrives.
Worth the wait.
Yeah, worth the wait. Hopefully it arrives in time for our opening this coming Monday, January the 8th, here at the Broadway Gallery. 6 to 8, you should probably show up.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And we want to take this moment after we were kind of looking at how great the show looked and all the works together, to sit down with one of the proprietors of the gallery, who's a legend in the downtown New York art scene. He's had a number of roles, a number of prominent galleries, some of which still exist, some of which don't. And we wanted to hear about what it's been like to collaborate with these two hot messes, me and you, Nate, and his history in the art world.
So Pascal. We're
pleased to be joined by Pascal Spengelman. What's going on, Pascal?
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you here.
I love hearing the installation still going on in the background. It's beautiful. It's sonorous.
The sound of a screw gun. Occasionally, don't be bothered by it.
This is how the magic happens.
These people work by the hour, man. We're not going to tell them to take a break just because we do a silly little fucking podcast.
Hell no.
They're on salary. Don't worry.
Okay, because we... Oh, is that working?
Healthcare.
Does that work into
our
net
proceeds?
Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about it offline. we're really glad to be here. I know it's been a long ride to get this show up on the walls. I think we first had dinner maybe close to a year ago in the Odeon around the corner. You guys had some martinis. Mm-hmm. We had some french fries. I forget what else we ordered. It was a good dinner.
It was a great dinner. I mean, like all dinners at the Odeon, because the Odeon rules.
Yeah, it does.
We decided we'd do it in January 2023, and then we sat on our asses and didn't really do a fucking thing until September, October this past year. And here we are, and it looks great. It all worked out.
A show happened. We did it.
That's true.
Much thanks, obviously, to Pascal, you and Joe for...
Well, credit where credit's due. I think Joe, being the originator of the idea, you gotta hand it to him. I think it was a great idea. First of all, he knew who to ask to do this kind of thing, and you guys were the ones to do it.
Never say no. That's my
yeah. No, we took to it enthusiastically. I mean, Nota Bene, this is the first time that we put a show together. First time I've ever done anything like this. Benjamin, you've put together a number of shows over the years. I mean, I was a
museum curator, and then I've subsequently done a number of not-for-profit and gallery exhibitions. This is my first one in Manhattan, in New York City, in a very long time.
Welcome back. Yeah.
I've been Aspen, the Hamptons, Mexico City, London, all sorts of other places, but in the hometown, it feels good. Now, how often have you guys worked with outside guest curators since you opened under the Broadway rubric?
We have not done that yet. I feel like there's always a conversation. We're always talking to a lot of people, so this kind of information filters in, for sure. But this is the first hired gun situation that we have undertaken, and it's judging by what's hanging out there right now, it's proven to be successful. This, you know, as you guys know very well, this can be a mixed bag when you're just going out to friends and friends of friends, that kind of thing. You never know how it's all going to shake out, and I think it's shaken out very nicely.
Yeah,
and, so thank
and,
you.
And dealing with like gallery collaborators, consigning works from other galleries can always be a bit of a challenge, because obviously they want to have the goods to sell themselves. So we were luckily enough to partner with a number of friends directly or through their galleries. And I think, you know, it looks like a real show out there.
It looks like a show. I agree. I think that it can go a lot of different ways, and it looks like an exhibition that has some real coherence to it. So I'm grateful for that part too.
Now, you and Joe opened the Broadway Gallery. Is this September 2020?
October 2020.
The fall of COVID.
That's correct. It was pretty abandoned out here. We opened with a show of Sky Hopinka, who was someone that I had been absolutely lusting after for a couple of years, since I had seen his work at the Front Triennial in Cleveland, actually. And so it just came together that he was able to do the first show, and given the amount of attention that he had, it really was great for us too, just because it put us on the map in terms of people knowing we're here. Also, there was nobody on the street, you know? It was really like critics, curators that had no offices to go to, and we were open, so...
Yeah, I mean, that was the month I came back to the city, and I came down. I saw it one of the first days it was open. It was a great show. It's also great because it was a real curator and critic focused show, I'd say. Like, it was a real serious, erudite, it was a time-based media, but it was a big
We had a 16mm film and some these hand-etched photos. So, yeah, it was a fairly, institutionally directed type of exhibition, I would say.
And the gallery was less than half the size than it is now. It was, now, right? Yeah. I mean, it was a tiny hallway.
It seemed big
space.
Enough at the time, it seemed just right. And even I was sort of like ambivalent about expansion, but as this space became available that we were able to move into, it seems insane that we had, how narrow it was. Yeah, it was very small. Given that where you're sitting right now, Ben, was our entire front desk.
Yeah, no, now you guys have this big cushy office, this great red leather couch that I've been kind of napping and sending my offering emails from the past couple of days.
I actually envisioned you guys kind of like psychoanalyzing me during this.
I could lie on the couch. That's the second half of the podcast.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, usually in my office, it actually is a psychoanalyst's office, so that's when we really get down to the brass tacks. But we wanted to do this from the gallery with the guys and gals installing the show in the background. Now, since October, you guys have expanded the space, expanded your roster. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, the show that just closed at the end of 2023 was with our friend and past guest, Andrew Kuo, mm-hmm. Who's been someone that you've worked with for a long time under a number of different iterations.
Yes.
How long have you known Kuo?
I guess we started, I first must have met him maybe 15 plus years ago. He was making at that time very different kind of work, these very elaborate cutout pieces. He was starting to move into some text-based work, but very different. This is when I had Taxter and Spengemann with Kelly Taxter, and she was really closer with him at that time and was really like in that studio a lot and with him. And as it changed, the work kind of like evolved into these chart paintings that he became well known for and he's continued to do. It really clicked, and she came one day and was like, we got to do this. And so we made a big show on our that 12th Street space in the old Frank Stella studio. That was kind of his like big debut with us, and it was a big space, and it, funky as it was and slanted and weird and cold, it was his big kind of statement of the new work.
Mm-hmm.
So
When did you and Kelly open Taxter's
Spengemann? I was still in graduate school at Bard at CCS. So it was 2003 that we opened in the apartment on 22nd Street. So it was like the kind of parlor floor. You had to buzz in. The space was smaller than this office. So we had that for a year and then moved across the street on 22nd to the townhouse.
What was 22nd Street and like Chelsea in general like in 2003? And what was it like to open a gallery when you were still, in graduate school?
It was cool. I mean, I had, Kelly had worked at Loring Augustine. I had no idea. I mean, I've been making exhibitions for years as a nonprofit curator, that kind of thing. I had done a couple of art fairs as an independent curator. So it was just kind of wild territory for me, really. The choice for us to open in Chelsea was really the most kind of salient point there, because we were small and the work we were selling was not expensive. We could have opened, in Lower East Side or something. But we kind of wanted to be where Chelsea was exploding then. And I mean, to be fair, it was the time, in the early 2000s, like everyone was opening galleries. That was kind of part of the thing, like everyone's doing it. Why can't we, So starting like all these things, same way that Broadway started, you start in a way that can show you whether it works, and then you grow.
Yeah, and I think of that moment in Chelsea, of the number of galleries, unfortunately, most of which aren't around anymore, I'm thinking, opening Chelsea, Becky with Bellwether, John Connolly with John Connolly Presents, Daniel Reich, Foxy Productions, I know I'm missing people, Wall Space, you know, this whole kind of generation of you guys kind of up right around that same time, but 2 or 3 years.
Definitely,
I guess. And we're really part of a community. I think of it as kind of the first Nada generation in my mind. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think there was a mix of both these new kind of compatriots, people that came up and started at the same time, along with, I also found like the generation slightly ahead of us was, for the most part, really cool about helping us, you know, just giving us advice, general guidance. You know, you used to be able to call, like I would call Andrea Rosen and be like, hey, you know, this museum's asking me to pay for shipping for something that probably cost $1,000 or whatever. Like, what should I do? You know, and she would tell me like, yes, do that or don't do that or whatever, you know, like how to advocate for myself. Cause we really had no, in so many instances, like no idea like what we were, you know, what the protocol was.
I mean, not to be a romantic about it or overly romanticize the not too distant past, but it was a smaller art world then. Mm-hmm, so you could call in that position someone like Andrea Rosen or, you know, whoever it might be to get advice. Or I wonder if that's the same. Are there younger gallerists that call you now looking for?
I mean, not that many people come to me for advice, let's say. But
do you think that same sense of community exists?
I've had people, yes, especially with the advent of Tribeca. I would say it's less around advice and more around camaraderie and like, I mean, I look and I see, you know, generationally it's Canada and Krebs and Chapter and all these dealers that I've known forever and admire and we're friends. And, you know, that felt really comfortable for us to open here. Like me and Joe starting a gallery, it was, you know, given all my experience, it was not necessarily clear what type of gallery we should have, right? Should it be in a third floor in the Lower East Side or somewhere uptown or whatever? But just driving around in 2020 in Tribeca, it was so clear, you know? And when we saw the phone number on the front of this space, the 373 space, I was like, we have to have this, you know? There was a cool space on 22nd Street, actually, near the Dia space, you know, that was small that I kind of liked, but I was like, I didn't see myself going back to 22nd Street.
You'd kind of done that, right?
Kind of, yeah.
Like, I mean, let's go back a little bit to the days of Taxer and Spangleman.
Yeah.
Other than Quo, kind of what artists were you showing that were having a lot of impact in the market? Like that?
Well, I mean, this show that you guys put together here, it really was making me think about this because the very first artwork I sold in New York, even before we opened the gallery, was a Matt Johnson sculpture.
Wow.
And the reason that I knew about Matt Johnson, he was in LA, I was in New York. I didn't know him. The reason I knew about Matt Johnson is because there was a couple at CCS, Anna and Brian Sharp and Anna Vejovic, I think I'm saying her name right, that were living there, and they were friends with Jonas Wood. And Jonas Wood came to visit, who I also had never met. And we were talking about something, and I overheard him talking about a friend of his who had bent a 2x4 in half or into a curve. And I was like, wait, what? Because I was interested a lot in sculpture, especially at that time, like predominantly. And he explained that he has his friend, Matt Johnson, who made this sculpture. So he put us in touch. And I put Matt in a group show that I did at the first Scope Art Fair.
Wow.
Which was, they invited me to just do a curated room for free, which I thought was really great because I was just came to New York. I was pretty green. And I sold that piece, I think, for like $2,000 to Andrew Ong, who still buys work for me now.
Andrew, I haven't seen him in forever.
He's around. He bought work from this gallery. So,
wow.
Great guy. I mean, he was bless an early supporter of mine at the New Museum, him and George at the time.
Yep.
That's very cool.
So they're really like cool. This show connects a lot of those dots, and it's something that I guess I pride myself on, and really makes me happy that like I can still have a sculpture by Matt and piece by Jonas in this show that you guys put together, just because it makes me feel like there's some real continuum at play.
I love the continuity of that world, the fan-like thing. Sometimes I get a little concerned in that Like I do these group shows maybe once a year, once every other year. Yeah. And a lot of times it's some of the same names coming back because sure. they're the people that, A, I think about their work a lot and it's yeah. important to me and my thought yeah. process about what contemporary art is and can be. Mm. And B, they're part of the social structure and they're mm-hmm. the people that I'm having conversations with about work and about yes. art in general, if it isn't their own. So they're the first people that I think about. And so there's something maybe a little bit too parochial about that, but I kind of love the small village sentient within the big city sure. of the art world.
Yeah.
There are little individual communities and how they overlap with other people's communities. Right. That's why working with Nate was really nice because he was able to bring in a whole other small village that's a little right. bit of a slightly younger generation.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
People like Kai Christensen Knowles and mm-hmm. Rebecca Ness and, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, these are people. I mean, Rebecca, I know a little bit, but like Kai is someone who's really new to me, you know. So that mm-hmm. there's also this other aspect of your exhibition, which is this artist who I'm not so familiar with, and so I like that too. But I agree with you that you know there are people who are kind of foundational for us or for me personally that, and they stay lodged in there. You know, Lars Fisk is another example mm-hmm. is an artist that we work with here. Tends toward like larger public kind of projects, but I've known him since I was 13.
Wow.
He was the first person I ever met that was like, I'm going to be an artist. Like when we were 16, I didn't know, like, you know, what the fuck? Yeah. 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 He was like, I'm going to be an artist.
Was he always crazy? And I mean that in the best possible ways. His ideas are so out there.
No, he's always been like actually someone who is focused on the studio, like the shop. I think this kind of performative angle to the work that we've seen more recently is an outgrowth of being in Red Hook, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he's just someone that like introduced me to conceptually to that as like something you could give yourself to at a young age. And I was like, huh, you know, my grandfather was an art teacher, you know, had been an artist and stuff in California, but of no real renown, but just, it wasn't unheard of to me, but just to have a contemporary define in no uncertain terms that that's what they're going to do. And then I started, because I liked being around artists so much, I was like, well, what do I got to do? I'm not an artist, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, so before you were at CCS and up at Bard, yeah. you had worked in a variety of not-for-profit spaces in definitely. Boston, Vermont.
Yeah.
I think that's the
Corcoran, D.C. I'd studied art history in college at the University of New Hampshire. And so Boston was the closest like metropolitan area. And someone that I knew there had been an intern at the ICA when it was in the old...
the Boylston that, Street the or
old,
Newbury
yeah,
Street.
Yeah, yeah, the old like... fire station kind right, of yeah. setup. And so I applied for an internship, which I got. And I think I was telling you this earlier, the person who was my handler there was Leah Gongitano.
Wow.
Who absolutely like blew my mind and has become my close friend. And like my, she's an idol of mine.
I mean, absolutely. OG, yeah, like real grassroots curator.
And she was at that point that I was intern there, a whole bunch of people had quit. You know, it was one of those things where like everyone, you know, just a decimation of the staff. And so she was basically, I think she was like maybe just a few years older than me and was like running the place. And she was so cool because I was like, okay, I got to learn something about being a curator or whatever. And she was just like, just hang out with us. And so I just hung around and, you know, she was so close with all the, what she termed eventually the Boston School people, right? You know,
who's that?
Mark Morisrow and Jack Pearson and all these people, who were part of her whole, like that mass art kind of, taboo, all these artists that she introduced, me to. And then, so many people that I worked with ultimately at TNS initially, I met through participant, through Leah, like Lutz Bacher, for example, I became close with Lutz just from hanging around at participant all the time. And when American Fine Arts closed, she was looking for a place to show. So Kelly and I started working with her, for example. So, you know, and careful who you intern for.
I mean, it, you know, it's how I ended up here. And how long did the Tax Credit Spangleman project last?
I think about 8 years.
That's a good solid run.
It was interesting because we started, like I was saying, like we were just late enough in the start. It was a great boom, so things were selling like crazy, but there was nothing was expensive. And since we focused a lot on sculpture, things were high.
production costs.
Production. We did a lot of performance. You know, Xavier Cha did 30 days of performances, like incredible, like transformative exhibitions that I was so grateful to be involved with. But, you know, when things are cheap and, you know, people that were really solidly for just a little further along in their careers, I think made out a lot better during that boom time. And then when the tap turned off after 2008, I mean, I remember this, the phone stopped ringing, like it just went dead. And we were sitting, you know, Kelly opened a bar in the basement of the 12th Street place. We were,
that's right.
We were,
I forgot parties. That. Yeah.
I was like sweeping up cigarette butts as much as anything, you know? And then, you know, once in a while, like Beth DeWitty would come like a fairy godmother and buy something significant and bless us.
Pay the rent for God. A month or two.
Yeah. And just like get us through. But ultimately it was completely, you know, just we didn't have like deep pockets or any.
Yeah, you didn't have backers or anything like that.
Nope.
So you closed that. And then how long was it before you went to go work for Marlboro? That was like, the next step, right?
Well, I'll say Carolyn Ramo came in and rescued us one time. And she partnered with us and we moved into the space on 18th Street, which lasted for another stretch of time, kind of gave us another lease, but it was just too tough of a hole to dig out of. And then once we closed TNS, I mean, I had no luxury of waiting around. So I was looking for work. I was thinking about that time. I actually had an offer at Dallas Museum of Art. I was thinking about going back to be a curator at that time.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had a baby and I was like, pretty freaked out, you know, I needed some stability. Yeah, sure. So I was really considering it, but Justin Lowe and Jonah Freeman introduced me to Max LaVey at that time, and I was like, okay, I'll go have a beer with this guy. And I went to the Bowery Hotel, and by the time I'd been with him for like 15 minutes, I was like, I'm gonna go work for this guy. I went home, I told my wife Chelsea, I was like, I think I'm gonna work for this kid. And like to this day, I really like adore Max, and he's a super you know, ambitious, pretty wild guy. And it was a wild ride for me, but like we did so many cool things together, and I have a lot of admiration for him.
It was a really interesting idea in that, you know, obviously there was an old school gallery and then to build within that construct, two or three different directors that have very different visions and ideas of what art was and the type of artists they were interested in working with and had them not working in competition, but in parallel. So it was kind of multiple galleries all under one rubric. And, you know, it didn't end up working out in the end for whatever reasons, but it was kind of a radical project if you think of it like that. I'm not sure if he conceptualized it that way, but if you were to kind of do a post-haste after-action report, it's pretty neat.
I think, the mix of, like, his ambition. I mean, that was something that I was never in a position to have, really, is, like, that kind of massive ambition or, you know, frankly, budget and stuff. I mean, to do survival research labs, to do Freeman and Lowe. I mean, Freeman and Lowe was already in the, they were working with him already. So that was his, Max's thing. And so that was just kind of how I got involved with it. But just like seeing what those guys were capable of and what Max was willing to put behind it and what the gallery was willing to just in terms of ambition. I mean,
And you guys really did it. Shows. Everything you did, you guys did like kind of perfectly, right? You know, because it was the capability was, I wouldn't say perfectly, nothing's ever perfect.
No, but
like in a really high level of professional competency.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, for Freeman and Lowe, for example, it really speaks to their organization and their like commitment to getting these really radical environments made. With survival research, for example, that was a whole other thing. Like that's a old school, really pro, really anarchic.
I remember seeing them do stuff in like downtown LA and like abandoned lots in the late 90s, early 2000s. Like those guys are the real deal.
Yeah. We did 25th Street with no permits and stuff. And it was like, just
they're like
praying.
Burning Man, pre-Burning Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like beyond that.
Well, I think Mark is really the inspiration for Burning Man, even though he was never really participating. But yes, like just that they would, that a gallery that with a long history as Marlboro would be like, okay, we're going to do survival research laboratories in Chelsea and 25th Street was like, it felt pretty great to me.
I mean, I remember in Mayfair, the last Freeman Lowe show.
Yeah, that was nuts.
Marlboro, that was like one of the most incredible art experiences I've ever had. And I didn't really expect it, especially in that building. It was incredible.
You're walking like down like New Bond Street. And then like, I just remember seeing Max and you and like, being like, come in. Like, this is like the day before and just been installed. And it was fucking mind blowing.
Yeah.
Like that was a crazy show.
Well, those guys' kind of commitment to the narrative ongoing narrative is so critical. And once you kind of get inside that head with them, and, you know, especially being able to experience like multiple of these installations from Art Basel Unlimited to, right, like you're saying, to London, to New York, it's a pretty ambitious and, like, I would say, like, holistic worldview that they enact there. That's like, that once you get in there, you can really kind of see where they take it.
And when, during this period at Marlboro, did you become close with Joe Cole? I remember you did that great outdoor painting show at him and Kristen's old house in Dallas. Kind of, how did your relationship begin? Well,
yeah, Dallas Art Fair was really where I met Joe. And the reason we got interested in Dallas Art Fair, because when we were Marlboro Contemporary, we couldn't compete with like the mothership for space and art fairs. So we were like, how do we participate in art fairs? And Dallas is one that was just kind of like a wild area, right, that we could do. And so we started making some presentations there. And I think through Adam Abdallah, I met Joe there, and we started, you know, he was a collector, and so he was interested in some artists. He was buying Quo, he was buying Mattelli. He bought Sarah Brayman, I think, from us during that time. And we just became friends. It was cool to like meet a young collector. He also had like young kid. Like, we were, you know, Max was unencumbered. And so there was an aspect to someone like Joe that was like, okay, we, you know, we could commiserate about our children or whatever. And so we did start to work on some projects. The outdoor painting thing, like you're talking about, was a realization of just something that had kind of nagged at me for a long time. Just, I walked past a house in California that just had a painting on the porch, and I was like, oh, that looks fantastic. I took a picture of it, you know, and I was like, oh, how can we do this? And, you know, I had seen, David Perry made this great show at James Fuentes, you know, this Welsh artist that was like kind of, someone that James showed. He did a show in the backyard of James Fuentes on St. James Place, which I loved. He like shellacked all the paintings, and it just looked incredible.
Yeah, I bought
a portrait of Kippenberger that he made. He was like a student of Kippenberger's. I don't know what happened to this guy, but he was a really interesting artist. And so that got me thinking about it. And so we installed all these pieces on the outside of Joe and Kristen's house, which they were so gracious to let us do. And we did it in collaboration with Canada Gallery. And it was, I mean, it was fabulous. It was good in pictures.
It was so
fun.
Cool.
It was raucous. Like, this
house
they
had was a significant piece of architecture.
It is, yeah.
It's actually been the house that Howard and Cindy built as a more livable family home after they got together.
Yeah.
Who was the architect? Do you remember?
I can't remember right now. Such a great house.
Yeah. But it's really like an inverted white cube.
Yeah, and I just remember but rolling up to it, like there's an exterior gate, and there's a Mark Flood painting on the wall.
There's a Keith Marison Statue of Liberty outside, a Mark Flood flag, Catherine Bernhardt, Bogan, Quo. It was Mattelli was in that show, some sculptures. Yeah, just seeing those paintings like kind of smoothly. I mean, they didn't. It looked like really nicely installed, you know.
Yeah, no, it looks crisp because the exterior of this house looked like gallery walls, just all white and tight.
So that was fun, and it kind of like proved that, you know, it just without knowing that we would work together more extensively. So then after that, we did a public project with Lars Fisk in a building down there. We did a presentation at the Jewel with Mattelli. During the art fair in the lobby there. And Joe is great to work with. He's like a highly competent person. He's very nice.
He's an operations guy, man.
Yeah, man. But he like loves art, and he like really looks, and he was buying this stuff. And so when everything fell apart at Marlboro, Joe was also in his transitional period, and he moved back to New York, and we kind of just looked at each other like, what are you going to do? I don't know. What are you going to do? And, you know, initially he was like, oh, maybe I would like, you know, get some people together to back you. And I was like, I think we should just do this. And thank God, because it's been great. Like I said, just the kind of the way our lifestyles are really similar, it makes for a very smooth thing. And also
couple of suburban dads
with a gallery. Suburban dads, and like, he's just good. He's good at all the aspects. So
yeah, you guys really complement each other well. Like, you're very similar, but not the same. Mm-hmm. And I think you kind of, just from the outside, like, it's a yin yang thing, where in ways maybe, that one of you, you know, has a strength here, the other has a weakness.
He has a lot of strengths. So if it's yin yang, I have a lot of weaknesses, but it's like,
well, you're something of an art historian.
I'm joking, but he's like, yeah, it's. He has an understanding of how to organize a business, but he also has an understanding. He has got clients. He's got ideas for artists. Like, it's very, like, all that stuff is pretty, pretty even, Steven, you know, the creative aspect. And he carries a lot of weight, you know, in terms of the operations.
Yeah. And you guys, you know, you started slow. We mentioned, like, the very, you know, yeah, hallway-like initial gallery. Yeah. You've expanded slowly. Now I think it's the perfect size footprint for where you guys are in terms of your program. You've added artists slowly, and I think strategically.
Yeah.
Not too much of this or too much of that. I mean, there's a true identity to the gallery, but yeah, I don't think it's, you know, it's not overly curated either. Right. I wouldn't look at a painting and say, oh, that's a Broadway-style thing. Yeah, and it's been a great moment to expand a gallery. Things are a little bit more challenging right now. But, you know, you guys were able to do the main Basel Fair last year. You guys gotten a big award for your booth with Sky, you know, which was a great thing. You've done some other international fairs. Yeah, I know you guys are doing a big thing in Felix coming up later in the spring with our friend Mills Moran's Felix Art Fair. And then you're also doing another cool project in concert with another gallery in LA, right?
We're co-presenting with Lisa Overton, a exhibition by the Texas-based artist Claire Oswald, who we've worked with. That's another person that Joe introduced to our program that he was close with for a long time and was new to me. And that's been great, like one of our real kind of stars of our program, actually. And so we're always looking for opportunities for her to expand like what she's up to. And Lisa had expressed an interest. I think they knew each other a little bit from LA, and so there was some of that. And I've known Lisa forever. We worked together with Frank Benson over the years, and we've always gotten along well. So she seemed like a good fit to try out LA for Claire. So we'll do that. That'll open during the Felix and Freeze week.
If you wanted to open a second Broadway, you know, you could open a space in downtown LA on Broadway.
I don't
Broadway West.
I'm terrified of second spaces, but yeah.
Yeah.
I take it.
I mean, there's just like a number of cities around the country with the Broadway.
It's like Springfield. So. Yeah.
who came up with the name, by the way?
Because
it's both so obvious and also just like unprecedented. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of all did. I think we were like playing around with, you know, not using our names somehow. And I don't know, we just couldn't really like think of anything. It's like one of those things. And there was already that cool gallery called Broadway 1602. You remember that kind of space?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't want to like, I mean, they don't exist anymore. Mm. There's like, I think there were like three other galleries called Broadway Gallery. There's like a frame shop somewhere.
Oh, really? That's
but
sick.
There
you
was
collab.
Some, yeah, there was some concept of like the un-Googleability of it that was like appealing, you know, a kind of like anonymity.
Great,
somehow.
Great for business when you have to go with that .nyc domain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. You know that something's going wrong.
Really
there.
Easy to give people your
but
email address. Yeah,
I found in the last few months, not that I wasn't Googling you before, but it's become increasingly easy to Google.
I hope so. I appreciate that. Sorry.
I hope someone's calling to
buy
some art.
We're in a place of business.
Hello.
We're in a place of business here. It's
okay. But what was I going to say? Yeah, so maybe around the name, I think we were somewhere at like Broadway Art Gallery or something, or Broadway Fine. Like nothing sounded right. And I think Adam Abdallah was like, just Broadway, man. Like he was just in there talking to Joe. And
always comes down to Adam.
He was the kinda Justin does. Timberlake telling you to take off the from the Facebook.
Yeah exactly.
That's
exactly.
Great.
Our first show, like I said, was Sky Opinka, and when Sky's show opened, and Holland Cotter wrote this like glowing review and a review of Sky's show that was at Bard that Lauren Cornell had curated at the same time, and it was like this full profile, full page thing. We got a lot of people coming to the gallery, and they were all pissed. Like, where are you? Where's the door? Like yelling at like, what is this? What's the name of this place? So yeah, it had its downsides, but it kind of felt like, you know, people would be like, it's so hard to find it. I was like, well, now you know, you're in.
Yeah, I mean, ordering an Uber to or from here is always a little bit of a challenge.
Gourmet Garage, so that's a tip for you. Always order to Gourmet Garage.
You got these great, you guys bought us a beautiful lunch from Sugarfish today, but then mm-hmm. the highlight for me, and I kind of OD'd on these Gourmet Garage, the chocolate dip, basically Oreo cookies.
Yes. That's been a recent discovery. There, it's their in-house brand of chocolate dipped Oreos.
It's crazy. Which it's fucking crazy is what it is.
They are crazy, and I think they represent probably 5 to 10 pounds on each of our stomachs.
I mean, the Gourmet Garage, it's one of the last old school.
Yeah, shout out Gourmet Garage. I love Gourmet Garage. And I'm so sad that the Broom Street one closed, but we still have this one. Hopefully it's going to stay in business.
Unshout out the robots checkout, though, man. I'm not
sure. Can you steal from them, though?
No.
Don't steal from Gourmet Garage.
We thought we had a beer hack back in the day where the beer was super cheap because, you know, when you would swipe the QR or whatever, the barcode. But it just turned out that was cheap beer.
Where are your other go-to lunch spots down here?
Yeah, in the area? Well, lunch, I mean, the restaurant that we love is Frenchette.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, we've had Joe on the podcast. Okay. We'll get to the Frenchette. I want to know about you.
I just wanted to clarify, it's really Gabrielle that makes
it. We love Gabrielle. And like,
that's all I want to say. That room is great. Like, I'm not a restaurant person, but I'm a person, and that's a person. That's enjoyable to be around. So,
wow, I love that.
I went to lunch there with some like literary people, like non-art world people, and Gabrielle like greeted me like very warmly, and they were all like how do you know this? Like how do you?
Oh
know?
Yeah,
it was great.
She makes you feel good. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it was there. Awesome.
Can I get an intro?
She's cool.
Sure.
Yeah,
she's because I just like the little sausages they serve with the oyster.
I like the room.
Unbelievable.
I love the room. The you know it feels the bar feels great, but like I like being a part of. That feels like being a part of something, mm-hmm. you know, over there. And we, to be fair, we went there a lot when there was nobody around here. So
yeah,
I feel like we put in our time.
You restarted it. Okay.
Yeah. We've been walking to Reveille to have lunch. We had Quo's dinner there.
I was there.
You were there. We'd it's probably great. Do another one there. We had great lunch there. That's not really directly in the neighborhood, but we go. And we love Joe's rice and noodle in the Canal Street.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hell yeah. Ooh, I want that for dinner tonight.
That's what I had today.
Those rice rolls are great. They're some of the best in the city.
Yeah. What are we doing for our dinner?
Let's not put it on the pod.
Oh, shit.
Ooh. It's not gonna drop until after Monday.
Yeah.
No, I thought it is dropping Monday.
We'll see how much time I have.
Okay.
We'll
talk about the dinner after it happens.
I thought Celine was gonna sponsor something at the
Odeon. That was my initial point. I was going to get Jonathan Anderson at Bottega to fucking do it.
What happened?
I don't know, man. Life happened.
Okay. Like, he said no?
No, I didn't get a chance to really put the ask in.
Okay. You know. Are you excited for the show? What do you think kind of the sleeper hit is, like, that you didn't expect? Like, it's always fun in a group show when you unwrap the things, the cardboard, the crates, you're like, "Oh, that's more interesting than I realized it was going to be."
That's a good question. Let me ruminate on that for a minute. I think that, like I was saying earlier, these like foundational artists, I was really excited to see Matt Johnson's new sculpture because it's a totally new move for him. He has a like robotic milling arm, you know, like a CNC thing that's in-house now, and that's carved sandstone telephone, like old school, like push button phone carved out of sandstone. I feel like that was a cool thing. It's not a revelation because I know this guy's worked for a million years, but it's a real new move. I think it's a very interesting material, and excited to
it's a sexy see sexy thing.
It's mm-hmm. a cool thing, and that as an object is a really good choice because it's such a weird nostalgic piece of equipment. That's
I mean, you guys have phones here in the gallery, but I was somewhere with my kids recently and they had no idea what a fucking like real phone
what
was.
A phone
like, what
was?
Is
that's
that
crazy. Yeah I feel like that's why that thing is an artifact or some, you know, Matt's always been good at like making recent technology feel like it was dug up out of a cave or something. You know?
Yeah. I have a client that has a great, like an OG kind of iMac carved out of wood, but painted hyper realistically with a rock that is like, and also carved wood and rock that smash the screen. I love that thing so much.
That's crazy.
It's a great sculpture.
That's a great sculpture.
I mean, he, along with Tony Mattelli, for me is something part of a group that I call kind of like post-Photoshop sculptors, where the work looks as though it's digitally made.
Yeah.
Like, because if you were to see it in a photograph, you'd be like, oh, it's just Photoshopped. But it's a real-life, three-dimensional, like, objecthood that's enacted in that kind of surrealist mode.
That's another connection with this show, is that Matt, when I met him, had just finished his tenure working for Tony Mattelli Studio. So Matt had been one of Tony's studio assistants before he went to UCLA.
And Jonas worked for Matt.
And Jonas worked for Matt, probably, at some time.
So, yeah, no, I know he did. He spoke about it on the pod.
Yep. And so, there's a lot of those kind of connections. Yeah, I agree. That kind of sculpture is something that's, you know, it's embedded in my DNA. It's not because I fetishize, like, technical skill or something, but it does something that you're talking about in terms of like a digital
there's realm. A notion of the uncanny that kind of you can unpack there, where it's, you know, that kind of like touches into your like understanding of reality and what is as perception, you know, as the viewer's perception gets kind of activated.
And Frank Benson, not in this exhibition, but someone who dealt with that stuff a lot, you know, making glitch-looking things really early on those TNS shows, where it looked like the sculpture was made in a similar way, but it looked like as if it had been like, you know, there was a glitch in the making digitally. But even though they were cast, and, you know, he quickly moved into a fully digital mode. So there's like a lot of ways to do that stuff. It's cool that we have some good sculpture in this show, I think.
Yeah.
All right. I think we should go out there and see if these guys hung things in the right places and everything's level, get our tape measures and our levels up. Pascal, we're so stoked to have been able to do this show with you, to record this podcast and get a little bit of your history down for the history books.
Thank you.
And we're looking forward to a fun party and making some sales on Monday. With that, Dr. Bene,
out.